This podcast is a production of KCRW.com.
From KCRW in Santa Monica, I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner, and this is The Business.
So you still want to do the show business, and you think that you got what it takes? I mean, you really got to rap and be all that, and prepare yourself for the breaks. Check it out.
Samuel Goldwyn said, "The harder I work, the luckier I get." This week on The Business, writer-director Richard Shepard got lucky at the Sundance Film Festival after 20 years of hard work. We'll catch up with him 2 years, two TV pilots, and a feature film later. But first, it's the Hollywood News Caravan. It's The Business from NPR. Yes, as the networks roll out their new fall shows, the Parents Television Council released its new report that's the same old story. They found that A, things are going to hell in a handbasket, and B, Fox's uber-violent 24 is largely to blame. The Watchdog Group's chief complaint is the death of TV's family hour, which, for those of us who remember the wonderful world of Disney, used to be from 8 p.m. to 9 p.m. Monday through Saturday and 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. on Sunday. Sex and violence during the early primetime slot have increased significantly during the last 6 years, the PTC found, although the use of foul language has decreased. I'll be damned. Broadcasters responded by saying that the family hour is kind of an outdated notion. With kiddie cable channels, DVDs, and TiVo, families don't need a family hour anymore. Another group called TV Watch, which is actually a coalition funded by broadcasters and not a watchdog group at all, called for greater parental involvement and blocking technologies like the V-chip, not more regulation. Giving credence to the PTC's concern about the demise of the family hour is Disney's plan to kick off a new incarnation of the wonderful world of Disney with Herpes the Love Bug. In international news, overseas reality TV is clearly more fun than it is here. During President Bush's visit to Sydney last week, actors from a certain Australian reality TV show managed to drive their fake motorcade through two checkpoints and get within a few yards of the hotel where the president was staying. When officers finally stopped the motorcade, which was traveling under the Canadian flag, an actor dressed as Osama bin Laden hopped out of the limo and into the arms of police. All told, 11 people from the show The Chaser's War on Everything were charged with entering a restricted area without permission. They were released on bail after agreeing to stay away from the summit for the rest of the week. In the meantime, we're looking forward to the spinoff of the Australian show, The Real World, Guantanamo. Elsewhere, CBS Corporation said last Thursday that it will pay $71.5 million in cash to buy Sign Story Incorporated, which provides more than 1,400 grocery stores with those annoying in-store video screens that air programs and ads. At last, a broadcaster gets it right. You're finally in exactly the right place to get a snack during commercials. And that's the Hollywood News Caravan. Coming up next, getting the upgrade from a coach seat on the Sundance roller coaster to first class on the Hollywood Express. Writer-director Richard Shepard's new movie called The Hunting Party opened in New York and L.A. on Friday, but it's been a long and winding and illustrative road. Shepard had been toiling in relative obscurity in the New York indie film scene for years. He'd managed to forge three films out of nothing more than sheer force of will, and they all had managed to turn a profit, mostly through foreign sales. But an odd set of circumstances landed him in the director's chair of his own script, called The Matador, with Pierce Brosnan and Greg Kinnear on board as the leads. The movie, a dark buddy comedy about a washed-up hitman and a naive salesman, was Shepard's last best shot at the big leagues. In 2005, we rode along with him as he tried to find a distributor for The Matador at the Sundance Film Festival.
I was on the plane with a lawyer, an entertainment lawyer, and he goes, yeah, for some people it's just a screening, and for other people it's, you know, it's their entire career is resting on one screening. And I'm like, yep.
In a drama worthy of daytime television, the North American rights to the movie were finally snapped up by Harvey Weinstein and Miramax for a hefty sum.
I feel blessed. This is, had there been a bidding war, what we ended up with would be about where our fantasy.
But the saga was far from over. Harvey was selling Miramax to Disney and starting a new company, and just who would distribute The Matador was unclear. And even if Weinstein did end up distributing it, the man they sometimes call Harvey Scissorhands could very well cut it into something even its director might not recognize.
I mean, the only thing I know is that, you know, if they cut my movie in any way that I don't like, I'll kill him and he'll be dead. So, you know, I have that over him. You can use what I just said because it's true.
I will
kill him. So, I mean, he could do it, but he'll be dead. So, I mean, I'll be in jail, but he'll be dead.
So, what happened? In December of 2005, Harvey Weinstein's new company, named The Weinstein Company, successfully released The Matador. Weinstein still walks amongst the living. And as we said, Richard Shepard's new movie, The Hunting Party, opened in New York and L.A. last week. Richard Shepard, welcome to the business.
Thank you, Claude.
Welcome back to the business.
I know. I'm very excited.
So last we heard, you were actually physically going to kill Harvey Weinstein if he edited your movie in a way you were uncomfortable with. What does it mean that he's still alive?
Actually, it's funny. On The Matador, people from his company said it was the first movie in 7 years that he hadn't recut. And I mean, I was shocked.
Let's go back because it's been a while since we've had
sure.
you in here. Take us back to right after Sundance, sort of, you know, what had happened, what was the deal, and, you know, what he promised you, basically.
Well, I mean, he bought the movie at Sundance for the domestic market, and he was just starting his new company. And, you know, he said, I think this movie is going to find a very smart audience. I think it's indicative of the type of movies we want. And I think Pierce Brosnan's going to get a Golden Globe nomination. And that might have also been one of the main reasons he bought it, you know, because he loves to get those award nominations. But the fact is that Pierce did get a Golden Globe nomination. It did sort of, you know, do what he thought it would do in terms of box office and the video and all that. And for me, it changed my career because I'd been hacking away for 15 years doing movies that my mother wouldn't even go see. And I was barely surviving. I was working, but completely below the radar. And The Matador changed that, even though, of course, it didn't make $150 million at the box office. It did what it needed to do to sort of say, hey, here's a filmmaker.
Did he market and distribute the movie as he had agreed to?
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, I think they did a great job. I think it was a hard movie to market. You know, the movie made $12.5 million in the box office, of which 90% of that was in the top 10 cities in the country. You know, it didn't really play particularly well in Kentucky or whatever. And then it did over $40 million on video.
So did you personally promote the movie as well?
Did I?
Yeah.
Meaning, did I do press for the
yeah,
movie?
Yeah, did you have
I
to go out?
I did so much press. I mean, Matador played it. 13 film festivals, and we did like 60 public screenings and then we did, I don't know, 6 or 7 days of full-blown press. I mean, we did, and Pierce and Greg and all of that.
What was that like? I mean, you go from being totally, I mean, no
well,
offense,
final,
but kind
finally,
of obscure
you know,
to...
I mean, it's just the weirdest thing in the world. You're signing your autograph, and, you know, I'm like, who the hell wants my... I mean, still amazed to this day. It's not the easiest thing to promote a movie because you were basically... You know, you're in 10-minute segments answering the same questions over and over again for days at a time. But if you don't do it for your own movie, you're an idiot. I mean, at the end of the day, if some press outlet wants to talk to you about your film, you should do it. It's like, I'm not going to be the one to say no.
I remember talking to one director once and said, you know, what's it like to do these sort of day in, day out, hour after hour
press junkets,
inquiries almost.
Yeah.
It's like a Senate hearing. And he said, the weird thing is you get asked the same question so many times that you begin to doubt your own answer. That by the third day, you're like, how is it working with people? I don't know. I think it was okay.
He
may be a bastard. I'm not sure.
Like, I had the opposite. I would just, you know, my feeling was I had to pretend to be answering like I'd never heard the question before. And that was part of like the challenge for me. It sort of took my actor instinct. I'm a terrible actor, but I just would attempt to answer the question as if I'd never heard, you know, what was it like to work with Pierce Brosnan, you know, question ever in my life. And sometimes you space out. Sometimes the questions are just so inane, you can't take it. And sometimes you have an interview that's so good, it kind of jazzes you up and you can get through the next 10. Mm-hmm. But it's a strange, it's one of those things they don't teach you at NYU Film School. They don't teach you many things at NYU Film School, but they certainly don't teach you that at some point you actually have to go and be a public voice for your movie. I mean, you do have to go and do that if you want people to see it.
If you're just joining us, we're talking to writer-director Richard Shepard. We followed him as he was trying to sell his first big movie at Sundance in 2005. A lot has happened since then. After Sundance, you're sort of red hot, right? This film has been scooped up. A lot of money has been paid. It has its unlimited potential. No one knows if it's going to be, you know, Little Miss Sunshine or Happy Texas or somewhere in between. And I guess what I want to find out from you is, you know, you had all these meetings right after. And some of them produced nothing. Some of them produced deals. Some of them produced TV stuff. You know, what was that like and how long did it last like that?
Well, I mean, you can always take a meeting in L.A. if you have an agent on any level. But you're usually meeting someone lower on the totem pole. So it was the first time that I got to actually meet the heads of the companies as opposed to the development people. Development people have always been really great to me. And it's not – but it's always – they're the first level of defense protecting the top person at any company. And so suddenly you're meeting these people and you're in a different sort of situation. You're in a situation where people actually care what you want to do next. I mean, as opposed to, you know, instead of me selling what I would like to do, they're trying to get me to do stuff for them. And so to be almost a buyer instead of a seller was an interesting change in the dynamic. And also just the fact that people would take the time to meet with me and all of that.
When you do these meetings, I'm curious if they already have you sort of pegged, so to speak. Like, oh, he's the quirky guy, so we should put him on, you know, our most straight and narrow product because he'll make this vanilla story about a...
I think you get that a lot. Because a lot of the movies that are certainly in any sort of development in the studio system, if they don't have a director attached, tend to sort of fit into some sort of formula. So they're looking for sort of someone to give it some voice whatsoever. How do you take what is just a straight ahead, stupid thriller or comic book movie and try to bring something interesting to it? And there is a need, I think, to try and find people with some sort of original voice to attach to it so it can get through the system as opposed to just languishing there. And also, you know, from a financial standpoint, a director who's got a movie that's really the first movie that anyone has seen of theirs out of the gate is a bargain, or they think, as well as hopefully they think maybe if you're interested in our stupid little thriller, you will figure a way to tell it in an interesting way that can get it through the system and get it green lit.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if there's any sense of time or constraints that we're hot only for so long and that we got to sort of
I guess so. I mean, listen, you want to strike while the iron's hot. There's no doubt. But if as a filmmaker, the last thing I was going to do was just accept the first movie that was thrown on my – I mean, a number of movies that were greenlit were thrown on my plate that I said no to. And it was the first time I'd ever really said no to anything. But you don't want to go and make the follow-up to a movie that has singled you out in some way as being original to then just be a cookie-cutter programmer. That seems to me not the way to have a long-term career. So that's one of the reasons I did some TV pilots – to keep working, to make some money, to keep working, to keep honing my craft, so that the second movie I did, the movie I did after The Matador, could be just as personal to me as The Matador was, which is what happened.
Let's talk about even the decision to do television right after having had some success in film.
Well,
how does it even come up?
Well, The Matador went to Sundance and sold for a lot of money, of which I've seen none. And we've now hired auditors and lawyers, and we're going after, people who owe us money on that movie. But I had worked on that movie for 2 years for Scale, which, you know, is very glamorous to make a movie. But when you're making, you know, after taxes, lawyers, agents, and all of that, and Scale, you're not making a lot of money. So I just needed to work. And what I just didn't want to do is go and direct, you know, Perfect Stranger. You know, I wanted to do something that. And so TV seems like a perfect opportunity. If you're doing a TV pilot and it doesn't work out, no one ever sees it. And if it does work out and it gets picked up, then it's great. You know, you've done a TV pilot that got picked up. So it's a win-win situation. And you get paid for 2 months, which, you know, far more than I had been paid on The Matador for 2 years. So all of that just was like, well, why not? And in the case of Criminal Minds, which was the first pilot I did, that the executive producer, Mark Gordon, was the executive producer of The Matador. So he sort of shoved me down CBS's throats, said, this is the guy I want.
Shoved you down their throat?
Yeah. Well, they were like,
Who the hell is Richard Shepard?
He did some indie Matador. They were not immediately thrilled and jumping up and down. But the fact of the matter is that Mark spoke highly of me. They did like The Matador, and it sort of – I got through a door that
normally I don't think I would have immediately gotten through. And then, of course, once I did that and they liked it and it got picked up, suddenly I have a deal to do another TV pilot. I mean, that's how it sort of works. You have to have someone force you through the system the first time.
You weren't in any way self-conscious about doing television or what it might mean, or that having worked so hard to get into film.
I think
because everybody in television is like, well, you know, as soon as we are on hiatus, my movie. You know?
Well, again, it was more of a situation on how do I find the movie that I want to do next, whether it was an original idea or an article, which is what The Hunting Party was. But whatever it was, how do I find something that I will be passionate about? And meantime, I got to keep working. I have to work. I mean, I have to earn a living. And so I wasn't self-conscious at all. To me, it was a huge deal. I mean, it was, wow, they're going to entrust me with, you know, helping cast and create and set a look for a show. I mean, that's a huge responsibility. So creatively, I got a lot out of a TV pilot that I would have out of a film, except in a much more compressed, I mean, all the pain and hair pulling out that goes on in a TV pilot is the same as a feature, except it's only 2 months and then it's done.
Now, we should name some of these shows because they're actually hit shows now.
Right. I did Criminal Minds, and then I did the pilot to Ugly Betty.
Okay. And both of them are doing
It's
fine.
Amazing. It is really amazing.
And you, of course, have a piece of Ugly Betty, right?
That's one of the great things about doing a TV pilot for a director. I mean, it's why a lot of feature directors do TV pilots, because not only do they get to, you know, work and do something creative, but they own a piece of the pie, a sliver. But, you know, I'll take the crumbs off of Ugly Betty. So that's all. That's amazing. And that certainly is the gift that keeps on giving to me. I mean, I shot that pilot before I'd shot The Hunting Party, and I just got an Emmy nomination for it. And all of this stuff that literally, you know, I mean, it's ridiculous. I mean, I barely, you know, got nominated for, like, you know, worst student of the year. I mean, it's just some stuff that doesn't happen to me.
Then you were also offered after this a very big Hollywood movie, which you, I think, cannot talk about, right?
I got asked to really seriously consider a big sequel to a gigantic movie that seemed like it would be a load of fun to do and interesting. And it was one of the few projects that was a giant Hollywood product that I actually was interested in. But to me, it was about making sure that if I was going to spend 3 years working on a gigantic movie, that starting from the get-go, we all agreed what kind of movie I wanted it to be, and it needed to be what they wanted it to be, because it's a sequel. The producers would be on it before and after me. And at the end of the day, it just seemed like the studio and what I wanted to do weren't 100% in sync. And even though it still could have been a possibility for me, it just seemed crazy to devote 3 years to your life if it was going to be through suffering. I mean, all the people I spoke to who had done these sorts of movies, who advised me, were like, make sure from the beginning you're on the same page, or else you will be just a giant cog in a machine. And, you know, there's something exciting about doing a special effects movie and doing a movie that actually might make a ton of money and all of that other stuff, and to learn all of that stuff and to work with good people. But to do something that would ultimately make me unhappy because of the cog in the machine mentality just seemed to not make sense. I'd rather continue to try and do my own material, or if I'm going to do a studio movie, at least it's going to be in a way that, you know, I can get the vision I want out.
How much filthy lucre did you turn down to stay happy? I mean, would it have been a huge windfall?
Yeah.
But like, how much money?
Well, we never got to the point where there was negotiation, but
millions?
Yeah.
We'll have more with writer and director Richard Shepard after a short break. We followed him as he was trying to sell his first big movie at Sundance in 2005. A lot has happened since then. His new movie, The Hunting Party, opened last Friday. You're listening to The Business from NPR. You're listening to The Business, and I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. In 2005, we followed a relatively unknown writer and director named Richard Shepard as he peddled his movie The Matador at the Sundance Film Festival. Harvey Weinstein eventually picked up the North American rights and also committed a sizable sum for marketing it. Capitalizing on the heat generated by The Matador, Shepard went on to direct the pilots for the hit TV shows Criminal Minds and Ugly Betty, for which he won a Directors Guild Award and was nominated for an Emmy. He was even offered the high-profile, big-money directing job of a mega-million-dollar Hollywood sequel, but turned it down. And now he has a new film in theaters, The Hunting Party, a dark comedy starring Richard Gere and Terrence Howard as two journalists searching for a notorious war criminal.
The Fox is the most wanted war criminal in Bosnia. There's a $5 million bounty on his head.
I know where he's hiding.
I know something's up. I want in on it.
You've been listening to my conversations?
The official term is eavesdropping.
We're gonna go where no bounty hunter, CIA agent, or U.S. Marine has ever gone before.
To score an interview.
You are out of your mind.
The Hunting Party opened in L.A. and New York last weekend. Did you have a feeling sort of gnawing at you as you were trying to decide whether or not to make this movie that if you didn't make it now, you probably never would get to make it? That there's that every movie has its sort of moment and every director sort of has its moment.
There's a
and
thing, yes.
Things kind of line up.
You want to take advantage of momentum. I mean, you know, the movie was developed at Warner Independent and then Mark Gill lost his job there, and
Mark Gill was, of course, the head of Warner Independent
Right,
Pictures,
and he had championed this project and wanted it done and basically said to us, if you can get Richard Gere and Terrence Howard and can do it for under $20 million, we will be your domestic partner with QED, who financed the foreign side. And we got those actors and we got them to do it for not a lot of money and because they cared about it, and we got a budget that we could do for that much for $20 million. And he couldn't get it through the system at Big Warner. Jeff Robinoff didn't want to do it. So that day was a really bad day for us because we had developed this movie there. We had the head of the company loving it. We had all these people ready to do it, but we couldn't close our deal with Richard Gere or Terrence because suddenly we lost our domestic partner. And that was on a Wednesday, and the script went out on to the town on Friday. And that was a really tough day for me because I was thinking, you know, for some reason this doesn't catch – it is such an individual movie. And if – for some reason it doesn't catch on, what's going to happen? You know, I've just spent a long time, a year writing this and then trying to get this talent together. And it was scary. But on Saturday, it went out on Friday. And on Saturday morning, Harvey called and was like, I'm doing this. And it was great. And on Monday, a lot of other people called. But Harvey called on Saturday. And
you got to do the impression of...
Hey, Richard, we got to do that. No, I can't do my bad Harvey Weinstein. I love it. This is brilliant. I'm touring Vegas. I'll be playing at the Sands. It was weird. My manager, Rosalie Swedlin, the day before, I was just a neurotic mess about the fact that Warner Independent dropped out. And she just said, just take a deep breath. Really, you're not where you were 2 years ago. You might still think you are, but you're not. And these people will read your script and will be seriously considered. I can't guarantee that it's going to get picked up somewhere, but it's a different place than you were before. And I did take a deep breath, and it did get picked up, and it did get, you know, Harvey did come in, and that was great. I mean, that certainly showed a difference of where I had been 2 years ago.
By the time we air, the Hunting Party will have opened in New York,
yes,
and Los Angeles. From the safety of this gray little room, how do you think it's going to do?
You know, I don't know. Audiences seem to really like it, and that's really exciting, you know, and certain of the press that have seen the movie so far have really liked it, you know, the two thumbs up, you know, I'm excited about that. But at the same time, it's a tough marketplace. I mean, I think 9 movies are opening, you know, the day that our movie opens, and then 10 movies a week after, and movies with a lot bigger advertising. I mean, I see 3-10 to Yuma ads everywhere, you know, and it's scary. It is really a scary time, so I don't know. My feeling is if people go to see the movie, it will have a word of mouth and it will do really well. But it's just a question of, are people going to even go see the movie?
So what is next? You're on a plane soon to Venice to tour this Hunting Party around.
Yes.
But what is next for you?
It's a good question. You know, I'm going to do another TV pilot for NBC, which I have a deal with to do another pilot. I'm going to do an episode of 30 Rock, which is one of my favorite shows. And I certainly, like, one of the benefits of Ugly Betty was that they would consider me to do a 30 Rock episode. So I'm actually – I haven't really done episodic like that, and I'm excited to do
that's
it.
That's a fantastic show.
Yeah, so that's actually in the fall, and I'm quite looking forward to that. And I'm writing a new script, and I'm for the first time having a few scripts written for me, which will be interesting if one of them pops and ends up being interesting. And I'm reading stuff. So I don't know. I don't feel the need right now to jump into something. I know we're all on this pre-strike. We have to get a movie going pre-strike and all of that. And I'm like, well, maybe I'll find something that will be interesting we can do pre-strike. Or maybe I'll just, you know, do some TV like I'm planning to do and use the strike to write an original one, which, you know, so we'll see what happens.
Richard Shepard is the director of The Matador. His new film, The Hunting Party, starring Richard Gere and Terrence Howard, opened in theaters last Friday. Richard, thanks for being on The Business.
Thanks, Claude, very much.
Brooks Barnes' August 5th article on Hollywood residuals in the New York Times was met with angry, even hysterical online chatter. And we've received a few angry emails about our mid-August interview with Barnes as well. While it's not our place to defend Brooks or his article, we do want to clarify some of what he said here on our program. Barnes said studios claim they need to recoup, quote, basic costs, unquote, before paying, quote, what they see as bonuses to writers, directors, and actors, unquote, since box office alone isn't covering the ballooning costs of marketing and special effects. Listeners, all of them screenwriters, by the way, were infuriated by the word bonus. But Barnes was merely stating a fact. Studios say bonuses, while writers call residuals part of their compensation, or wages. Some screenwriters directed us to a blog called The Artful Writer, which claims that residuals are payments to screenwriters for the use of copyrighted material. Neither bonuses nor wages, they are simply negotiated equivalent to royalties. But the fact remains, when a studio hires someone to write a script, the studio typically owns the copyright on that script. They may call the writer a co-creator, but they aren't a co-owner. In our interview, Barnes said that it's hard for, quote, the average union worker who's blue-collar and not in that Hollywood world, end quote, to feel sorry for either side, since studios make, quote, billions in profits, and some writers are getting paid at least $1 million a script. End quote. Note that Barnes didn't say every screenwriter makes $1 million a script, just some writers on, quote, a major budget film, released by a big studio. He went on to say that the union has, quote, scores and scores of writers who are not working at any given time and are making it by on those residual payments, end quote, and that canning those payments could hurt, quote, young writers more than established ones, end quote. We should add that the studio's threats to eliminate residuals may just be a bargaining tactic, as some claimed in their letters to us. But that doesn't mean it's not going to happen. As folks without a horse in this race, we'd like to suggest that the rhetoric be toned down a notch and that actual discussion begin. Even big-name producers and talent we've talked to say the way pay is doled out in Hollywood makes no sense at all, that it's done that way simply because it's always been done that way. And with that, we humbly exit this conversation. Stage right. And that's The Business. Matt Holzman produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. Our associate producer is Darby Maloney. You can listen to this or any past program online anytime at kcrw.com/thebusiness. You can also podcast the show on KCRW's site or through iTunes. Our email address is thebusiness@kcrw.org. The Business is produced by KCRW Santa Monica and distributed by National Public Radio. I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts covering politics, news, music, arts, and culture. For more details, visit kcrw.com.